Welcome to a two-part Armistice Day special, where today I'm joined by Regan Hughes, who is a Royal Marine Commando veteran, as well as being a postgraduate student at the University of Glasgow in International Relations. Please join us as we discuss the British holiday of Remembrance Day, the American holiday of Veterans Day, and the international holiday of Armistice Day, focusing on the symbolism and the history of these holidays and the wars that these have been affected by and created by. Also taking a focus on the lessons that we have learned and the lessons that we should have learned from past conflicts and these holidays. This is also to focus on not just our dead and the veterans such as ourselves, but the civilians that are often overlooked and the lessons about military intervention and political intervention. I hope you enjoy today's special. Hello and welcome to the Rights and Wrongs podcast, the podcast where we talk about rights, privileges, misconceptions. Today I'm joined by Regan Hughes. We're going to talk about the symbolism of Veterans Day, Armistice Day, and Remembrance Day. Before we get started, I want to ask everyone to join me in a moment of silence. It's something I'm trying to do all month. This is not just for the veterans and not just for the fallen. It's for everyone that's been suffering and currently suffering or died during a war. This includes civilians, people that step on landmines from wars that were placed 20 years ago. So please join us. All right, thank you. So as I said, my guest today is Regan Hughes. I'm going to let him introduce himself. If you want to go, Regan.
Hi, I'm Regan Hughes. I am a Royal Marines Commando veteran of 14 years. I left the Marines 6 years ago. Since then, I have completed an undergraduate in law and business, currently at Glasgow University, doing my master's in international relations. And because of this, George has kindly invited me to speak on today's podcast.
Thank you. And yeah, I met Regan, strangely enough. I think it's funny, we both got into took a human rights course for the same reason, where these are things we go to war for, but we don't know what they are.
There's a lot of literature on there, the shrine of human rights, how it's kind of driven us to actually go to war, probably more often than avert war.
It's a confusing thing. I think that's one of the most common justifications for war, which is sad. So for all the vets out there in America, happy late Veterans Day. And for all my brothers, happy late birthday. It's 245th. And I guess that's a cousin birthday to you for being a Royal Marine.
Yeah, well, yes, no, we're doing quite well at the moment. I mean, we're technically older than the United States.
So. Well, you guys are like our older brother, so by a couple hundred years.
We do a lot of cross training. I was lucky enough to do some cross training with you guys as well.
But so today we're going to talk a little bit about Armistice Day and all this stuff. Armistice Day, obviously marking the end of World War One at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month when the guns fell silent. In the United States, we call it Veterans Day, and I'll go into a little bit of the history about that later, but it's Remembrance Day here. And there's a lot of symbolism and a lot of differences. Did you want to get into that and explain?
There's a difficulty because I think what we have now, what we think of Armistice Day is not Armistice Day as it was. It's what we think it was and something that we've made. I don't think it's as much, although we remember the dead in name, I don't think we remember the dead don't really have a voice. I don't think so. We're giving them a voice. It reminds me of, The Hollow Men by T.S. Eliot, where he's talking about effectively that the protagonists are stuck in a purgatory. He said, our verse actually goes, our dried voices, when we whisper together, are quiet and meanest as wind in dry glass, or rat's feet over broken glass in our dry cellar. So what we have these days, we're not listening to the dead. We can't see the dead. We don't think we can look the dead in the eye, brutally honest. And what we have now is what we think Armistice Day should be. I think it's very much more hero worship of the living than it is a mournful remembrance of the dead. I think there's a lack of, well, not a lack of regret, but I don't think we're learning lessons. I think the lessons we are learning make war more inevitable than less inevitable.
Yeah, it's a very strange thing. So I went to a Remembrance Sunday for my first Remembrance Day here, and I went to the University of Glasgow where they had it at the main hall because they don't want to hold it in the chapel, for the chapel is named for the dead.
Yeah.
And it was interesting as an American, because I've sat through multiple ceremonies, whether it be from the Sons of the American Revolution, Boy Scouts of America, and the Marine Corps VFW. And it's interesting how you say that there isn't the sorrow, because there is a strong, like, mourn during that. And I don't think I've ever really felt that outside
pride of Christmas. But I think it also comes to the culture of America where we celebrate war. We don't really mourn it. But that's the reason I find it interesting between the 2 days.
No, you're right. Absolutely. And that's the thing. I think remembrance is incredibly important. I think how we remember it, I think there needs to be a little bit more diversity. I think it's slightly monopolized by a particular voice. And I think that voice is veterans like myself, or not like myself, but veterans on the whole. And the Royal British Legion, who are a charity, but there is a political agenda there. And there's not much room for outsiders, because you do have the white popular bill. And they're confronted by people, especially, not by everyone, but by elements. The Peace Union lay poppies on cenotaphs. So some of them are removed or destroyed, not by the authorities, but by the just random people who are looking to preserve a very singular view of what armistice and what remembrance is. And I think that it's a shame. I think we need to open it out a little bit more to discussion rather than this kind of monopoly that seems to have occurred. And I think the problem here is that a lot of what we feel today is that there's a very single idea, a homogeneity. There's a very single-tracked view of what remembrance should be. Whereas the history of Poppy Day is actually bathed in conflict and argument, because people were, again, one, they were physically tied to the war. They physically experienced the war. They physically experienced grief and loss. And there was class divisions as well. So the polity of the time, the politics in the country has completely changed. So the homogeneity we have now is not reflected of the lack of homogeneity we had then, with class divisions, social divisions, and it's turned into something a little bit different.
It is fascinating to hear about that, for the way that the Brits talk about Remembrance Day kind of makes me wonder how Americans were talking about Memorial Day about 50 years after the Civil War. Because the way you look at Remembrance Day is the way we look at Memorial Day, referencing the Civil War. Because for Americans, World War One and World War Two was that thing that happened 1,000 miles to the east or 3,000 miles to the west. Like, it was something that wasn't at your front doorstep. But World War One and World War Two, like, the city we're standing in was bombed during World War Two. Like, that's the strange. The last time we had a huge fight in America was the Civil War, when you really think about it. So, like, you have that, and like, now we have the Memorial Day for that, and we have Veterans Day, which we call Armistice Day for the living. And there is this strange, I don't want to use the mutation, but there is this weird evolution of what these holidays have seemed to go.
Yeah, no, definitely. I definitely think there's been that change. I don't think it's been a recent change. I think Armistice Day here has always been changing. Like I said, there is always a weight. There is always a mournfulness and a sorrow. But I don't think it's that the weight is not comparable to that was in 1919. And people forget that there was actually a military parade in the July of 1919. It was triumphalist at most, and people weren't really feeling that. It was only at the first Armistice Day in 1919, the Tournament of the Unknown Warrior, where it was very much, the emphasis was placed on the people and the politicians, but there were still arguments at the time about what was going on. I mean, a lot of veterans at the time, or some veterans at least, were opposed to these celebrations, to memorials, because there was a kind of a hypocrisy. We were spending money on memorials and on parades, but we weren't spending money on the victims of the war. So casualties of the war, or the widow and the lame, as they were called, were left destitute, penniless and homeless. And we were spending money on parades.
So that's a strong parallel with the United States. One of the reasons, like, people might not know why we call it Veterans Day in the US, it's very similar reason, is you had the people return back from war, and like, you had the Roaring Twenties, so people were like, too worried, because you come back and like, you basically were guaranteed a job. But then we had the Great Depression, and then all these people that fought through the war, like, they're getting, the banks were like foreclosing on their houses, their farms, they weren't getting the medical care, and just because they couldn't pay for it, but like, they got gas to defend America, but yeah, they're not getting anything. So we have something, if people aren't familiar with it, look up what we have, what's called the bonus marches and the bonus riots in DC, where you basically had legions of veterans march on DC, and they blocked the stairs to Congress. They wouldn't let the senators go in until they promised to vote on what we now call the creation of the Veterans Affairs. And it wasn't until 1938 that they formally changed the day from Armistice Day to Veterans Day and made it a federal holiday. But it was kind of a strange thing where it's like, yeah, they're honoring the vets. But when you really look at the history, it's this kind of strange thing where it's like, we changed the holiday in the name of you, to stop the veterans from complaining. And it's a weird thing in American history. Where I'm from Massachusetts, veteran rebellions are a common thing in the United States. The reason we have a US Constitution is because of Shays' Rebellion, because they did the same thing to the American Revolutionary vets. They came home after the war, their houses were foreclosed, they weren't getting paid, and they went to overthrow Massachusetts government. And that's when they created the Constitution for a stronger federalized military to stop this.
I think that's echoes here in the first Armistice Day. The nature of the Armistice Day was born out of a fear of unrest, because it was documented by diaries, by academic texts and studies, that there was an unease and an unrest about how this was to be carried out, which is why the mournfulness and the weight that you experience is that why we use the politicians rather than religious ceremony. Monarchs take a little bit of a back foot as well. Again, like here, obviously the Queen will lay a wreath at the cenotaph in London, but she is not the centre of the ceremony. And a lot of that came from drawing back what was going to be planned, something a bit more bombastic and something a little more reserved.
It's very subtle, and it is a strange thing where you hear that there's power in subtlety.
Yes.
Absolutely. And like there are some things I think you guys do really well here in Remembrance Day. Like, we're not really allowed to travel too much because, if people aren't aware, Scotland's still kind of on a lockdown. But I did make my way to George Square a couple of weeks ago, and they have the mock-up wreaths and crosses of every single Scot from the area that has died within the wars in the last year. And sadly, people are still dying in wars. Like we're talking about, like the numbers aren't, it's not huge, but still one is too many when it comes to war. But it is a very mournful thing. I did want to ask you, why it is the symbol for Memorial Day as well, but you probably know this better than most. Why is the red poppy the symbol for Remembrance Day?
A lot of it goes back to obviously the First World War and the poppy actually growing in the fields after the deshelling. So that there is a sense of rebirth, color red in there. So there's a shedding of blood. So there's a lot of symbology in the poppy. So it seems obvious why it's adopted. Because I think, and again, I'm not 100% sure on this, but I think it was initially Canadian. It might have been British first.
Because it is this.
You might have to correct me on that one. Now, but that there's an argument. There you go. He's talking about Armistice State. He doesn't even know where the poppy came from.
It's a curious thing too, because I didn't know it was a Memorial Day symbol until I looked it up myself. But I'm not sure if we took it from you, because America likes to, we were talking earlier, America likes to take from other cultures.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it was initially Canadian. Maybe someone can help us there. But there is, because a lot of the poetry of the time will remark on the poppies, Flanders Fields, etc. Again, he was a Canadian medic, I think, or he's with a Canadian medical corps. But there's the symbol of loss, rebirth, and bloodshed, all in that one's weed, effectively, that wild plant.
No, it's interesting. For those that don't know, in America, the symbol for Veterans Day on the 11th is the yellow ribbon. But that comes from that old song. I think it's actually a British song where, like, she wore a yellow ribbon for that man.
I think it's a yellow ribbon around the old oak tree,
yeah. Yeah. And, like, or she's, like, started pushing a baby carriage, that yellow ribbon. And it's basically became a symbol, like, during, I think, the Civil War. I can't say if it's for both the South and the North, but it was very prevalent in the North. If your boyfriend or husband or partner, however you want to go, that was in the war, you'd wear a yellow ribbon and people would then know. And it was like the sense of pride kind of thing, like one of remorse, but he's fighting for our country. And
no, absolutely. Yeah, no, it's the same with the poppy. And I think the symbol itself, like the poppy that you see, which is ubiquitous with Poppy Day, is the British Legion poppy, which is actually copyrighted. But you could wear any poppy and everyone will know that you are supporting Poppy Day, that you are acting. It's a symbol of remembrance. It's a symbol of Armistice Day. You are part of the occasion, but obviously it's also a symbol that you have donated to a particular charity. I think it is a political symbol. There is debate around whether poppy is a political symbol or not. Even the Royal British Legion on their website call it a national symbol, and any symbols within a polity or a society within which a polity or a society are represented, that is definitely a political symbol. And we're surrounded by many political symbols which are ubiquitous. We're surrounded by flags, we're surrounded listen to national anthems, national football shirts. These are political symbols, but they're rendered invisible. And to some extent, the poppy is rendered slightly invisible because it is so ubiquitous. It's still a PR campaign to some effect on behalf of the RBL, which I think has a little bit of a monopoly on remembrance.
So I do also find that strange how you guys only have, not only one, but like in America, there's a ton of veteran organizations. We have the Veterans of Foreign Wars, VFW, the American Legion, the DAV, which is like Disabled Veterans Alliance. There's a bunch in America. So there is kind of, and it's also strange because you do have those groups and they start to infight with each other because they want to be the organization. And it's a kind of a little strange when you look at it from the outside.
As I said, there's definitely one voice, but there are many voices out there. And this one voice drowns out the others. And I don't think it does it on purpose. It's a large organization and it has been around for a long time. But so is the White Poppy. The White Poppy's been around for a number of years. I have no issue with the White Poppy. I wore a White Poppy last year. I didn't want wear any poppy this year. I didn't even, without being disrespectful, I didn't do anything for remembrance. And I don't think I should have to either. That's the other thing.
No, and that is, we were talking a little bit about this before we got on, but there is a strange cohabitation of patriotism and military duty. And we were kind of trying to talk about it, but I wanted to ask you through the British society, but in America, you have this strange notion that like we have to fight for war because like my ancestors were American Revolutionary fighters. Sorry, my ancestors probably were fighting your ancestors in a lot of those ways. But this, because of the fact that we had that fight for freedom in America, and like that's from the beginning in the trenched in military culture in the US, you constantly have to fight for freedom. Like there's no questions of stuff. And that's the reason I find there's no issue wearing a white poppy. There's no reason someone should be mad about someone that fought for a country wanting peace, because that's kind of what you're fighting for. Most soldiers and Marines and warfighters will tell you they're fighting to stop the fighting.
Yeah, that's a classic just war scenario. It's not the preferred option, but sometimes war is necessary. I think a lot can be lost in translation. I think what we do nowadays is that a lot of our modern conflicts are basked in the light of World War II. Everything is judged through this lens of World War II, which this is the classic just war. It's good versus evil, as far as anyone else is concerned. But we judge the First World War off it. We judge Rwanda, we judge Bosnia, we judge Sudan, we judge Iraq. We invoke human rights very frequently when we commit our forces to any foreign theater. The idea of the other savage is invoked quite often. Look how they treat women, look how they do. They don't even educate their children. So it reminds everyone's familiar with a gladiator, and there's a scene at the beginning, and it's this idea goes, why do you fight? Why don't these people know when they're conquered? He says, and he's asked why he's fought by Maximus Aurelius later on, and he says, the world is a dark place, Rome is the light. But all cultures think that. Everyone thinks there's an element of superiority. With the intent of doing good, we do a lot of harm at the same time.
No, it's true. When you look at anyone that looks at things, and I know like I, on this podcast, I seem very crucial of like military and like my own personal government, but there is some like really strange misconceptions and wars full of misconceptions. One thing I always found strange is when people were justifying the war in Afghanistan was that like we're bringing democracy to these people. They were a democracy back in the 1400s. Like before like the first English settlers landed in America, Afghanistan was a democracy. It was ran by the tribal leaders and they elected their leaders, but it was a republic in many of the modern views. But then Russia came in and messed things up, and then America has to come and fix what the Russians, and then you have all that. But it is when you have that idea that like we are the light and we need to spread the light, in the whole idea of, and human rights is this huge issue. And as you and I both know, human rights is kind of pushed a lot of the times for war, that it's this perfect preset, set in stone way of living, but it's closer to cotton candy than anything else. It's sweet and easy to destroy and dissolves in water.
Though I think it's difficult these days because the wars we fight, there's a huge asymmetry. We are superior in both numbers. We are super, and again, I don't like using the word we, and I don't like using the word superior, but there is a military superiority. Technical aspects, there is a numerical superiority. So the wars we are fighting are very one-sided. The technology we employ keeps us at arm's length. And the wars that we see through our TV sets, to the point where you can watch a missile fly into a window, strike a target, and we consume these images. Whereas before, people came home, and again, we have casualties now. We incur loss, but not in the sense and the scale that we have done. And I think that has, I think we have grown distant, not only from the dead of World War II and the dead of World War I, but we have grown distant from the atrocity of war conflict. I mean, it's very clinical. It's not war. We think we're touching war, but we're definitely not.
No, it's a very true statement. A lot of people, I don't think they realize, I talked about this a little bit on the previous episode from when this is uploaded. The U.S. military and like the militaries around the world is there's less and less warfighters on the front lines. There's not these massive battalions of infantry. Like if you actually look, the Marine Corps just got rid of their, the U.S. Marine Corps, not the Royal Marines. We just got rid of our tanks for the first time since World War II. We no longer have tanks because they're just seen as not needed part of the mission because we have Predator missiles and we have all this stuff. If you go into the Air Force, it's strange to think the Air Force is about 3 or 4 times larger than the size of the Marine Corps, but there's more fighter pilots in the Marine Corps. But it's because in the Air Force, they're not focusing on fighter pilots or bombers. They're focused on satellites and technology. More Marines were all trained for infantry roles. But they're electrical engineers like I am. They're aviation techs. They're combat engineers. They're admins. They're lawyers. You're right, the militaries are still the same size, but we're not on the front line, so there's less people to bring back these messages of horror and war is.
There's definitely a sense of war at arm's length, and that's not the same for everyone. I mean, for myself, perhaps yourself, you are much closer to a war than anybody else. But I don't think many people are closer to war than the dead themselves. And I think the people who experience the greatest tragedy are the civilians. And I know there is the argument that we are going in there to help them. But when you look at the death tolls, they pale in comparison to 9/11. They pale in comparison, if you add the death toll of both US and UK forces in Afghan and Iraq, they still pale in comparison to the civilian casualties that have mounted up, whether through a combined or whether caused by coalition forces.
That's the craziest thing about it. And like, it is also the scary thing about, as you mentioned, this war from arm's length, because it is the civilians that suffer the most. The one thing I've always had the biggest issue with, and like, this is not really just the veterans, but it's like the use of landmines. Like the U.S. still hasn't signed the Ottawa Treaty. And that's the biggest killer of civilians out of like any piece of weapons ordnance. But that's because we place these landmines, forget that we placed them. 20 years later, a kid goes chasing his ball and it's a strange world.
Absolutely. I mean, there's been, we often invoke, again, and this is the light of World War II. We invoke the light of World War II quite often. And this is one of my major problems with remembrance, is that we remember our dead, but we don't remember the mistakes we made. We, as an empire, as a nation, we have not been good people. We have used chemical weapons quite frequently. We used Agent Orange in Malaysia after the Second World War. Was it the Briggs Plan? I can't remember whether they put that into effect completely. But they attempted, could only be classed as ethnic cleansing, where they tried to resettle 500,000 ethnic Malaysian Chinese people. and there was a small massacre there as well, which doesn't help. So again, we paint ourselves as the liberators, when often we are not the liberators. We are just as guilty as anyone else.
Yeah, it is so true. And it's a hard subject to touch with a lot of people, because the strange thing is these conversations that we're having, a lot of people think, maybe in America, like not saying like all people, but some people would think of us borderline being treasonous in the way that we're speaking against, like, how dare you go speak out against like veterans in the military? And we're not being against the people. It's just, we're kind of crucial and critical of the society that created these issues.
Yeah. Oh no, absolutely. I think veterans are guilty of wielding experience as an authority and a sacred power. How dare you question me? I have been there. Do you know what I have done, what I have sacrificed, what I have put on the line? When what we have is something very short-sighted. Mm. We need to take a step back and be able to see the bigger picture. So it's not an entirely societal issue. I think it's very much been driven by the veterans. And it did, I mean, the history of Remembrance Day was driven largely by veterans, because it wasn't a big thing. Like I was saying, it didn't really get big until about 94, 95. The Remembrance Days we've had since, especially in recent years, have been bigger than they ever were. And we are getting further and further away from World War I and World War II. But when it wasn't popular, when it wasn't as big a thing, when the grief was still tangible and thick in the air, people were less keen to be not involved, but I suppose they remembered in their own way. Now it has become more of a ceremony than it has ever been in its own history.
Yeah, and it's a crazy thing. One thing I also find very fascinating as being American in the UK, though, is the issues that you're talking about too. I see them in America every day, but it's also fascinating. I'm not saying fascinating, it's actually horrifying that those are secondary to other issues that we have for war in America, because our veterans and war fighters are fighting for the right for healthcare and mental health, because we don't have the NHS. We have the VA, but you have to prove that you are hurt in the military to get healthcare. Like, I hurt my arm in the military. There's no paper trail proving that. So the VA is not going to help me. But if I'm a UK citizen, like, it's fine now. But like, if I was a UK citizen, it doesn't matter if I hurt myself in the military or not. Your arm's hurt, you're getting healthcare. You guys also have a better view towards mental health. Like, I know people here that have mental health issues, and it's treated as a weird analogy, but if you need mental health, it's treated as a broken arm. Get your help. And
it has got better. It has definitely got better. If we look at both physical injury and mental injury, it's only in recent years that we have got better at dealing with it. In the early stages of the Afghan war and the war in Iraq, veterans were coming home and they were not cared for properly, not by the state and not by the military themselves. It's only as we sustain more casualties. And this is because more people survive really catastrophic injuries in war. We have got much better at saving people. The more people who are less likely to die as a result of a bullet wound or an IED strike, we are capable of getting them home with barely intact, but they will survive. So we ended up with a lot of guys coming out of theatre and there wasn't really appropriate care at the time. It has got better. And a lot of charities are built around this. And that raises the question, why should there be charities? Shouldn't the state be prepared? Shouldn't the military be prepared for these casualties to come home? If you're going to send guys to war, if you are going to put bodies on the line and ask them to do these things, then you need to be prepared to look after them when they come home. So there's this echo that there was in the First World War. I mean, on a much greater scale back then, but we were not prepared for these people to come back in the state they were. And there have been failures, monetary, medical, mental, there has been definite flaws, but we have been getting better at redressing those.
Yeah, like I'll say, like, it's no system's perfect. It's just one of those perspective things where I'm coming from a country that is, and it's not the VA. Like, I'm not mad at the VA. They're doing the best they can with what they got. Like, they're making miracles out of stones with what they have. It's just the government's not giving them what they need or the information that they need. A lot of it is that they don't ask the veterans right away, or we don't. One thing I find very strange in the United States is, like, PTSD, people are claiming this is a new thing that's been happening, like, oh, the new war is the PTSD, but we always had it with shell shock. But it's also, even without war, you have PTSD from people with car crashes, sexual assault, and it's just trying to get the information to the right people.
Absolutely. And I just want to pick up on something, talking about post-traumatic stress. I think the act of remembrance itself is partially an act of that comes out of experience of trauma. Again, very much from the original part of World War One, there was definite trauma, there's social trauma. So that trauma undergoes transformation. Remembrance is paradoxical because a central element is social forgetting. We have forgotten a lot from World War One and definitely from World War Two. I mean, a lot of what we do now is based on World War Two myths. And there's a disassociation from the trauma of those wars. It's undergone a transformational process, and it's common in individuals that suffer from PTSD, that suffer self-blame and guilt. It makes it easier for us to process the aberration of war. The remembrance has been driven very much by the leader, by the services, by people like me. The use of tones and words like glory, I think, covers up a multitude of sins, because when you use words like glory, you forget about the pain and the tragedy and the embarrassment that dying isn't fun. There is no glory in dying. And I think it makes it more palatable. It makes it easier for us if we make it more noble. When I struggle to find now the nobility in dying and in inflicting pain upon people, no matter how just we might find it. And again, I'm not anti-intervention, but I don't think we've learned the lessons where we think intervention should be a last resort, that there are other ways. War is more complex, and it definitely shouldn't be oversimplified to just war theory, where it may not be it may not be the best method, but it's the only method. There are other methods that we fail to address, and we very quickly go for the trigger on when it comes to intervention.
Yeah, there's I feel horrible now because I'm trying to remember this author's name, but there's, look up a paper called, for anyone's listening, this paper called The Humanitarian War. It's by a famous human rights thing, and he always calls humanitarian war is the most prolific oxymoron ever put to paper. When he goes into it, it makes sense. Like, how do you save humans by going to war, which is going to cause, because most human rights tragedies are a result of war. So fighting a war, it's a very strange cycle.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And again, like, always falls into this just war theory. And the biggest, one of the biggest arguments about just war theory is governed by realism and relative strength and not ethics. The strong will do what they will and the weak will do what they must. We've been living in a unilateral power scenario for a long time now, where the United States and their allies have had pretty much free reign to recreate the world in a particular image. But we regularly flout the rules. We engage in torture. We engage in mistreatment. We use weapons that cause extreme harm to innocent people. When they get children, fat non-combatants, people who are not involved. They are not part of the asymmetrical power, with the terrorist organization or the Taliban or the freedom fighters, however you want to class them, or the large state powers which they're fighting against. They're caught in between, and they pay a higher price than all of them.
No, and it's so true. And it's just such a strange thing. Like, you and I have both been to, like, these countries that we're trying to help. And it's one of the weirdest things I've ever noticed, and I've heard other people say the same thing, is when you see children in Afghanistan or Iraq. I wasn't in Iraq, but, like, everyone's like, oh, these kids don't have health care and they don't have this. But it's like, okay, we need to get the health care to them and we need to get this. But at the same point, like, when those kids, you give those kids a soccer ball, that's the happiest I've ever seen, like, a kid. Like, I've seen, like, my friend's children stuff get, like, an Xbox and complain because they didn't get the right game they want. You give one of those kids there a soccer ball and they're elated. And it's, I don't know how to tell another country how to live, where, like, I can't remember the last time I was that happy for something. So,
but again, it justifies, a lot of the time it justifies our intervention as well. It goes, look, these people have nothing and we're bringing them everything. And what we're not bringing them everything, we're bringing them tragedy a lot of the time.
Well, let's say that it's great when we're there. Like, the military, like, they probably love it when a military base pops up in Afghanistan. But what happens when that area is no longer strategically needed and we move?
There's a large amount of economic right. You invade a country, even if it's conducted as counterinsurgency, which Afghanistan was, it creates a big hole, and we plug it with. I've not got a sufficient analogy. I can't remember one at the minute. But we're trying to plug a hole with a very, very small economic finger. That dike is just you're going to drown. It's not going to be fun.
Yeah, and, like, that's the whole entire problem too. I always find it interesting when we go there and you're talking about the America trying to rebuild, and we try to bring American democracy, which there's other forms. Like, it's a parliamentary system here in the UK, and it seems to work fine for the UK. Same thing with France. And,
oh yes, crumbled.
But, like, the thing is, but you try to, like, force our ideals on other countries, and it's, like, kind of a strange thing trying to force. Like, I followed the Afghan and the Iraq, like, especially Afghanistan, followed them. Like, their struggles with democracy. And the problem is the people just aren't familiar with this. And it's not that they're stupid or anything like that. It's the culture. And, like, this is not a symbol. Like, this isn't a government they chose for themselves. It's a government we chose for them. And you can't have a government for the people if the people didn't have much of a say.
We have had the benefit of going through, again, I'm going to air quote, the age of enlightenment, as it were. I mean, we have had, our history has involved certain processes, and it's involved wars, economic emancipation, political emancipation, and it has grown. You can't shift that wholesale into another country. And this country has suffered numerous times because of our imperial powers. It's been sandwiched between imperial powers. Iraq has been involved and sandwiched between and cut up and divided by kings and monarchs that have been placed there because of imperial powers. And now we're going back there again, going, look, you're doing that all wrong, and that leader needs to be replaced. And now we're giving you the gift of freedom. It doesn't work like that. And we need to allow certain processes to take place. We should aid certain processes to take place. Technology sharing, again, trying to encourage economic emancipation. We turn around and we invoke the treatment of women very often when we invade. Look at these savages. The women are not even allowed to sit in the front of the car. They can't do this. They can't do that. They can't vote. It's only very recently that our women have been allowed to do the same. We're not very good at treating women. It was still legal to rape your wife in marriage in the UK up until about 2000. And it took a long time. I mean, to call ourselves like, raise ourselves, and again, this is a self-appointed pedestal, to place us on that pedestal, a self-appointed pedestal, it's a bit of a reach to then turn around and tell people this is how they should be living.
No, and it's very true. One analogy I always like to use for America is we're still suffering very strongly from mismanagement after the Civil War in the United States. Like, that's where all the police shootings, the systemic racism, all this falls back to the Civil War and before. But then it's strange to think about, like, oh, it's a really harsh thing to deal with. But then you look at Germany, and Germany had the Nazis. And you look 60, what's been about 60 years now, and they have come a lot farther in 60 years than America has in twice that. And it's very interesting because that was an international intervention, and America was we intervened ourselves.
No, absolutely. I would like to go to Germany around Armistice Day. There is acts of remembrance, but there's a very different tone. I think Germany came out, and again, this will sound odd. I think the transformations that occurred in Germany were very beneficial. I don't think we really cottoned on the autocratic monarchical powers that were used by the Nazis, by Hitler, to centralize power were abolished post-World War II in the rebuilding of Germany. You can't do anything in Germany without the power of, or without the consensus of the German parliament. Whereas, again, we've seen in the United States an incredibly autocratic leader willing to subvert the democratic process, willing to centralize power. He's gutted the State Department. He's accountable to nobody. That's an autocracy. America prizes itself for the decentralization of power. In the United Kingdom, we have the same problem. We have the royal prerogative. And this is the other thing. We have Remembrance Day, but we are very keen to go to war. In Iraq, there was parliamentary debate. There was protest. So it's not one-sided. People were very much against Tony Benn, an amazing politician. He spoke out against the war. Voracious. I mean, he's an amazing orator. And there were big protests. But on the other side of that, you had people, and again, it's happened again and again, who are invoking the use of the royal prerogative, which is the wielding of a monarchical autocratic power, which is not wielded by parliament. It is wielded by one person, maybe wielded by the cabinet, but the prime minister is effectively answerable to no one. This doesn't mean he's answerable to no one. He has his cabinet. But the cabinet are not answerable to all to the parties. The cabinet and the prime minister at the time can do what they want, regardless of what parliament says. Where Germany have routed out and reconstructed their constitution and built something very, very stringent. Now, there is a little bit of pressure currently in Germany regarding this. Whereas the United States and the United Kingdom, these same strange little autocratic powers exist.
No, and it's fascinating that you talk about this too, and it's important for us to realize, because we talk about remembrance and like it goes to the veterans, but we do also have to remember these wars were fought for reasons. You don't have to agree for them, but there's usually a reason for war. And I usually say, hopefully there's a reason for war, because if there isn't, why are you going to war?
That's the thing. Usually there's a reason for, I forget the full title of the book. But it's basically called sleepwalking. It's how we slept. We basically blindly blundered into war, in the Great War, in the First World War. People went to war, and again, we have built stories and myths around the First World War, and we acknowledge them. We acknowledge the reality of great power politics, how people were basically fighting for. Well, it wasn't for freedom. They were fighting each other because the great powers, because politics, because diplomacy had failed. And we blundered into this massive war, not really knowing why. And a lot of innocent people lost their lives because of it. So the idea that there's a reason for war, I mean, we can trace it back. We can turn around and say separatists who were fighting against the Austro-Hungarian Empire knocked off Franz Ferdinand, they then start snowball from there. But that's just a point in time. What should have happened is someone said, hold on a minute. That never happened. Everyone went full tilt. No one backed off. They all flew into a war without really knowing why.
Well, I think it's also important too that we talk about Armistice Day and like World War One, because if anyone is a true, and there's a difference between a war historian, because I have a lot of friends that are military historians and they care about the weapons, the tanks, the tactics, but watching why we went to war is a very important reason. If you look, honestly, I'm sure you as an IR major and myself as an international politics major, I get very nervous of what's going on in the world, and not just because what's happening in America. I believe it was, I want to say Hungary, they gave full unlimited power to their prime minister about, I want to say, less than a year ago. China's doing grabbing territory left and right at the moment. Russia is being Russia and has their fingers in everything. But America is back to the same way that we were after the Civil War, where we're slowly becoming isolationists. We're focused on issues internally, which we need to do in the United States. But it seems like right now we're not caring what the rest of the world does. And it's dangerous because when we did that the last time, and I'm not trying to say America should be the world's police, and I don't agree with that, but we can't have this isolationist mentality that we're having right now and focus too much inward, because the last time that America was isolationist, someone was grabbing power, England was in a debacle like it is, well, the UK is in a debacle like it is, that's when World War One happened, when all these small little things happened.
I wouldn't go as far as to say World War One happened because America was isolationist.
I don't know, that's what I'm trying to say, like there, but we were late to the party, as Lenny like to say.
Yeah. Oh no, definitely late to definitely late to the party. But it's just the failure of great power politics. And very much here, it has always been the kind of the lion that lions led by cowards, Hague effectively just used to massacre people. I was talking about Blackadder before we started. They mocked this line, this historical line that we use, it plays throughout. You walk the Hague is in his office and he's overlooking a battlefield and he's got toy soldiers marking out divisions strewn across this this big model, this diorama. And then he looks at it, scratches his chin, pulls out a dustpan and brush and just sweeps them off the field, throws them in the bin. And this is this metaphor for how much the state really cared, how much the great powers really cared. Yes. And that runs throughout. But this has kind of changed very much in the last few years, especially marking the centenary of the end of the Great War. There has been a concentration on the individual voices, which is good because we are learning lessons about the people who went, rather than looking at it from the great power perspective. But at the same position, what it's also doing is it detracting from the failure of great power politics. It's detracting from that line, which is very, very strong in the history of World War One.
No, and it's very true. One thing I'm also really liking to see is technology, I feel like, is helping us out, like things like this, like podcasting or people with YouTube videos. It's easier to get that smaller, more precise perspective that the big media might not want to show or the government might not want to show. Because I do like the BBC, but I also have to remember when I'm watching the BBC, that's a government-owned network.
It's technically not a government-owned network.
It's not government-owned, or is it just...
No, it's not like a Russian state media. I can't remember. I am having to kind of dig deep here. The way it's run, it's accountable. It's accountable to the people, but it's not a government run. They don't have the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation are a power within themselves, but they are accountable. So they don't get told what to do. They don't get told what to say. I think they were very much a reflection of society. I mean, they used to be called auntie because they were kind of the moral judge. This can't be said, that can't be said, that's distasteful. Ooh, two guys kissing, can't have that happening. But media, the BBC is probably one of the best, it's a paragon of media broadcasting as far as news broadcasting is concerned. But it also reflects certain societal ideals. It is patriotic in the sense that you get a lot, you have a royal correspondent. It is patriotic in the sense that it covers Remembrance Sunday. There are certain threads that run through it that run back a long way. It's very Middle England.
And that's the reason I appreciate it, because it's not like Fox News or CNN in the United States, which, like, I'm not trying to say, like, anything that is run, if it is run by the government, there are pros and cons to both sides, because we have very, very split, divided news in the United States, and the governments have no real control over them.
I mean, but at least Fox News, when they started, they said, was their tagline the right news for the right?
Yeah.
I can't remember how old Fox News is. Fairly old. It's not like not BBC old, but that was their tagline. And this is one of the problems I have with the media. I mean, we're going off, a little bit.
But, no, it goes off into the...
But one of the problems is the media is the way that people talk about the media. And they go, the media is biased. Duh. We know the media is biased. Everyone is biased to some extent. But when you're dealing with the media, you take the fact that it's biased into account. You read from a breadth of sources and come to a rational conclusion. What tends to happen is people tend to read the media that they agree with. It's Zala's RAS model, isn't it? It's like accept and reject. If you accept, like your Sun reader will accept everything that comes from the Sun generally, and your Guardian reader will accept everything that comes from the Guardian, but will reject immediately the opposite. So the Guardian reader will reject everything read in the Sun. The Sun reader will reject everything that's read in the Guardian.
No, and it's true. Like, we're not like too off topic because we're talking about remembrance and symbolism, but we are a media consuming society, both in the US and the UK. So we have to be aware of these things because they're the ones that set the tone in a lot of ways. One thing I did want to ask, like, I try to stay a little bit out of the elections till I know everything that's going on. But what is your perspective as a British veteran to the American military parade that we had?
I have honestly not seen the American military parade.
Well, you heard about it though, didn't you?
I was this the one that Trump instituted? Is this
yes.
I'm not big on military parade.
Neither am I. It seems like
being isolationist and then effectively saber rattling. I don't think they go together.
Well, it's like strange because I have a lot of friends here in the UK, and like it's strange how like a lot of people even in the UK have feelings about like when you go to London, you have the royal stables and like you have all that stuff, and like they call that saber rattling and all that things.
Yeah.
But then you America, it's never done a military parade. It was a very strange thing to have because that's something that like Americans used to make fun of the Cubans and Russians for having.
But we've started to do something similar. We've always had, there's traditions. So Troop in the Colours, for one. Mm-hmm. Troop in the Colours and the Queen's Birthday, these things happen all the time. They're a little bit more subdued. They're not as, again, they're not as, we're not driving ICBMs down the mall. But it's not so much a show of military strength, whereas these big parades of large-scale military strength are... they don't sit easy with me. I don't enjoy them.
No, I feel with you. I think it's a different thing with like when it comes to like the Queen's birthday and stuff and having the military go by and do a salute, like that's a royal, that's something that goes back centuries and like part of something. America, we're really big about muskets. Like I know the SAR will do, like we'll shoot off the muskets as a salute. And like, that's something that we'll do. Like that's our military thing. It was just very strange in, I think like 2018, we're America, we're still a baby country. We're less than a quarter millennia old. But to now implement a parade, like if we started that under Washington, that's one thing. But like starting it under the 45th president, it was a strange play.
It has. I mean, you've got this, you've had the growth. And again, it coincides with economic collapse. And this always, I mean, it's history repeating. If everyone's doing well economically, everyone tends to an extent, get on. As soon as there's an economic problem, then we start to turn on each other. And we've had a growth of the right. We've had a growth of these strongmen leaders. So we have Putin and the oligarch. We have, is it Viktor Orban in Hungary?
I think so. I get confused with all the world leaders at the moment.
Yes, we've got Viktor Orban in Hungary. So we've got Bolsonaro in Brazil. So we've got the growth of these isolationist, nationalist strongmen, and these military parades go hand in hand with them. They're the policies of populist leaders, aren't they? Really, it's the building of the wall. It's the same thing. They're grandiose, and they appeal to certain elements within. And they're fairly easy to implement as well. And it's a show of strength and a show of national pride. And who doesn't agree with an element of national pride? No one disagrees. No one really hates their country, do they? And it's easy to say, turn around and this is the thing. When you disagree with it, you go, what, don't you love your country? You go, well, no, it just depends. It depends. Make America great again. This is an interesting, because who turned around and said, make America rubbish? No government's policy was make America rubbish or make America worse, was it?
Well, it's also all based on perspective too. Cause like when you hear people say make America great again, like America is better even under Trump. America is better than it was 30 years ago, but that's just because the natural progression of society. Like if people are talking like, let's go back to the 1950s. I'm like, if you or me, we're white men. America was probably great in the 1950s for us in our perspective, but not for America as a whole.
But there is an element of there's relativism there. If Trump remained in power, would there be a rollback? Would segregation come back? No, probably not. But that's the thing. Even now, there is a form of segregation. It's argued by a number of social scientists that what we have with economic areas where effectively people, again, usually of an ethnic origin, find the right term anymore, but obviously I need to use it because that's the only one I've got available. But we have these communities which are effectively corralled economically into areas. So there's still a certain amount of segregation. There's segregation in terms of pay. There's segregation in terms, and again, these are not laws, but they still exist. And the laws have gone, but the system that keeps people in place, and there's an element of prejudice. And I always acknowledge that there is an element of prejudice in most, if not every person, whether they're aware of it or whether they're not. But these systems remain in place and they need to shift.
Thank you for listening to part one of episode 7 with Regan Hughes. If you enjoyed this, please keep an eye out for part 2 will be released shortly after this. If you enjoyed the podcast, please rate and subscribe us on whatever device platform you're listening to. If you want to help support us, look at rightsandwrongspodcast.com for donations or buy some cool merch, such as a hat, a beanie, or even a mug. We also do have a Patreon at rightsandwrongspod, where you can get some cool perks, such as joining the Discord to talk with me and other guests in between episodes, along with getting some behind-the-scenes content. If you would like to be on the podcast, please feel free to message me at rightsandwrongspodcast@gmail.com. If you have a story that you would like to get out, but you're not comfortable speaking on a platform such as this, I also do have a blog on my website in which I do articles written by people such as yourself. So feel free to send me a message or an email about what you'd like to write, and I can send it to my editors. I hope everyone has a great day, and thank you for listening to the Rights and Wrongs podcast.